Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So when you next hear the word rogue, you may no longer think first of Sarah Palin. As you may have been hearing in the news this morning, Swiss bank UBS announced late last night that a rogue trader within its ranks made $2 billion in unauthorized trades. That's right. One guy, allegedly $2 billion with a B, dollars in unauthorized trades. This morning, 31-year-old London-based trader Kweku Adeboli was arrested. As you can probably imagine, the Swiss bank is reeling. Stocks are down. The top brass is claiming they had no idea what was taking place, who us, and questions are flying about how this could happen, what it means beyond UBS for the global economy, and what it says about how much risk big banks are still willing to take on. Heidi Moore is New York Bureau Chief for Marketplace and joins us on this. Hi, Heidi. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is an unauthorized trade? Was this man allegedly stealing money or just being overeager and trying to make money for UBS?
Definitely overeager and trying to make money. Generally, the way these things happen is that a trader gets a certain trade in his mind, something he really wants to bet on. He bets a bunch of money on it. He might do well for a while, and then he loses money. And so he bets more to try to make that money back. And that can obviously metastasize to huge levels. I mean, $2 billion is the biggest rogue trading incident in history, right, just in raw dollar terms. But it happens because traders get something called cocaine brain, which means that they once they win, if they keep winning, they literally just cannot process the fact that they're losing. And so they keep trying to cover their losses. And that's probably what happened.
So these are unauthorized trades, meaning his higher-ups didn't authorize them, but they are legal trades?
I think we should take a measure of skepticism about the word unauthorized trades. It's very difficult in the banking system to rack up anything like $1 billion, much less $2 billion, without somebody else knowing about it. And actually, this trader's boss, John Hughes, has already stepped down, according to the Financial Times.
But it's not the same as a Ponzi scheme like we think of with Bernard Madoff, where it was fake trades.
Right. No, these were real trades, but the idea is that they're saying that, you know, the bank didn't know about them or didn't say, go ahead, you can press the button on that trade. Usually what happens is when trades get big enough, they have to be approved by people, and those people say, okay, you can press the button. You can go ahead and do it. So in this case, the bank is saying, we didn't approve it. They're implying that there's been an element of fraud.
This trader, Kweku Adeboli, sits on UBS's exchange-traded fund desk. What exactly does that mean?
Sure. Well, these are funds that trade on an exchange, almost like stocks. And they have been a really popular center of finance for about 2 years now. They're called ETFs. That's the acronym they go by. And we've seen them in everything, you know, from gold to, various kinds of stocks. They've become incredibly popular as a way to try to invest in areas that you wouldn't necessarily want to buy, you know, stock by stock or piece by piece. So you buy this entire fund, and then you can trade that fund and make more of your money.
Is that like the ads we always hear for Sector Spider ETF?
Exactly, yeah.
Heidi Moore from Marketplace, my guest on WNYC. All right, Wall Street folks, if you are listening to this and hearing this news for the first time, or maybe you read it this morning or hearing it on the news this morning or saw something about this on television or the web, what do you think? If you're in this business, what smells here to you? What do you think is going on other than what you already know? Give us a call if you've worked on Wall Street, if you're somehow connected to that world. What were you thinking when you heard this story today? Could this happen here in the U.S. in 2011? Technically, I guess this happened in London, but UBS certainly is based here, too. The ramifications will come here. Or is this so 2008? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to WNYC.org. click on Brian Lehrer Show. Is there really a chance, Heidi, that the top brass at UBS didn't know about this, that these really weren't some kind of authorized trades, or at least most of them, where the bosses had cocaine brain too, and they all were trying to make more money after UBS's losses, like all the big banks lost money in 08?
Yeah, it stretches credulity to believe that nobody else knew about it. The question is, how high did it go? Coincidentally, or perhaps not coincidentally, UBS announced last week that it was going to have a $2 billion loss and that it would have to lay off 3,500 people because of it.
Mm.
So that $2 billion loss seems awfully similar in amount to this $2 billion loss. We don't know yet if they're connected, but that tells you in job terms what this really means. This is real money, and so that's what makes it hard to believe that somebody in the bank didn't know more about it before it happened. And the question again is, how far did it go up and why didn't anybody tell him to stop?
Wow. So thousands of people's jobs may have been at stake if that $2 billion was this $2 billion. Or maybe this is going to be another 3,000 jobs if this is yet another $2 billion. We don't know yet, right?
Exactly, exactly. And in a way, in a sick kind of way, you know, maybe the other banks are a little jealous because they're going to make less money this quarter, and at least UBS has a rogue trader to blame, right? The other banks are dealing with issues where it's just harder for them to be profitable. UBS has made it harder for themselves, but at least they have this one thing they can point to as an anomaly, and, you know, maybe people won't sort of blame them long term for that, although certainly they have to answer questions about what's called on Wall Street risk management, which is, do you know how much you're risking?
Yeah, and to put this in the context of the overall worth of the company, if I have my numbers right, UBS is worth $44 billion overall, so a $2 billion loss from unauthorized trading or from anything is a lot of money. That's, you know, like 5% of the entire company's value.
Yeah, I haven't checked the numbers myself, but it is real money. I mean, we're not, you know, I know it's a global financial system and, you know, banks like UBS actually have trillions of dollars in assets. But even so, I mean, $2 billion really is significant. We haven't gotten so, you know, blasé about the meaning of that kind of money. And especially for a single trade, it's absolutely enormous.
Let's take a call. Here is Vic in Chester, in New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hello, Vic.
I'm sorry. Yes, I just found it very interesting that the term cocaine brain was used.
Have you heard that before?
Well, unfortunately, I have heard about it back in the 80s, the problems that we experienced in the stock market was fueled by cocaine. You know, I heard stories about, you know, investors being paid in cocaine.
Right, and that
awards
was
in their desk.
I remember that in the end, but I think Heidi meant it more metaphorically.
Right,
well,
it's an effect.
Metaphorically, but I'd be very, you know.
Your question is: were drugs involved here? Is that your question?
Well, I guess it comes down to here's another example of people just doing things, and where is the accountability? Is the bank just going to say, oh, there was a mistake and won't happen again?
Or it was one bad apple, and we're on this guy, and this didn't have anything to do with the institution. And thank you for your call. That's one of the central questions that we're asking here. In fact, Heidi, wasn't one of the things that we learned about in the wake of the 2008 meltdown that within these banks, there were entire divisions taking on all sorts of risks, mm-hmm. collateralized debt obligations and, you know, whatnot. Now we know those terms too well. And the heads of the banks had no idea?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of this has trouble trickling up to the very top, mainly because people are so interested in hiding it. But, you know, today is the third anniversary of the fall of Lehman Brothers. And when
it's September 15th. You're right.
That's right. And when we let Lehman Brothers fail, we blamed it on moral hazard, that Lehman Brothers deserved to fail because it was taking too much risk that it couldn't afford. And, of course, this is how we celebrate the anniversary, right? This right now, this giant example of still taking huge amounts of risk. Now, in the U.S., we have tried to make progress on limiting that. If you've been following the Dodd-Frank regulatory reform in Washington, there's something that's a part of that called the Volcker Rule. It's named after Paul Volcker, and he insisted that banks try to split off or limit what's called proprietary trading. That's when they trade for their own accounts. They're not trading for clients, but just to make money for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where this happened. And he said that when banks don't, in proprietary trading, banks can hide a lot. And when they don't have somebody watching those systems, which they, you know, they don't have to have regulators, you know, pouring through those as regularly, they can take really insane risks. You know, they're only limited by their own appetite. And here's a good example of that. So,
there's an example of where, after the Dodd-Frank reforms, banks in the United States are more regulated in terms of risks than banks in some other countries, apparently including Switzerland. But isn't this the exact reform that they were lining up at the Republican presidential debate Monday night to demand be repealed?
It might have been. I mean, the problem with the Volcker rule is that it's a hard sell, right? It's not what brought the banks down necessarily, but it is still a huge center of risk, and this supports Mr. Volcker's point.
Connie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I'm calling because I feel like I have something that I can add to the discussion.
Good.
I heard one of the people who called in before talk about who's accountable. And in today's society, I'm finding that the public is constantly, you know, in a situation like this, looking to the banks to be more accountable. And there's a lot of lawsuits out there. But the reality is that this isn't that unique. Back in 2001, I worked on a derivatives trading desk, and one of the base metal traders did exactly this in copper. It wasn't to this large of a scale, but it was the same kind of thing, and he hid hundreds of millions of dollars worth of a loss. And in today's banking environment, there are actually rules in all of the commercial banks that require that each trader take a minimum of 2 weeks consecutive time off, so that their superiors can go through their trades without them being on site, so that irregularities like this can be seen. I don't know what happened at this particular institution. I don't know if perhaps he was on vacation and that's when they found it. And I do agree with your speaker that his immediate supervisor with something that large would have had to see it. But it's, you know, when you're discussing it and you're discussing it in a vacuum as if mm-hmm. this is some thing that never happens. I hate to admit this, but traders are bonused on their P&Ls, and depending on the time of year, whether it's an end of a quarter, they do high trades. Not all of them, not the good ones, not the moral ones, but it's not such an anomaly. I wish it were, but it's not.
That's a fascinating insight, Connie. And so the reason we're hearing about this now, and it's kind of lifting the veil, perhaps, for the general public on this ongoing practice that you're talking about, is that this is so big, $2 billion, and he got caught?
It's so big, he got caught, and the bank can't absorb the loss without people losing their jobs and problems.
Right. They can't sweep
Typically,
it under the rug.
You would never hear about this. The person would get fired immediately. I mean, I have seen this more than once at my company, at other companies. Well, at my former company, I'm not in the industry anymore. But the person immediately gets fired, and that's what's done. But the public would never hear about it. But when you're talking about $2 billion, I mean, that's a significant percentage of the net worth of the institution. So obviously, this is going to be a huge problem, and there are going to need to be explanations made not only to investors but to the public at large.
You've added a lot to this, Connie. By the way, Connie, John on our comments page writes, all transactions of this size should be only allowed with the actual transfer of the physical money, a large tractor trailer full. It is too easy when it is only numbers on a screen. Then people will notice. And he writes, just kidding.
If only it were that simple, it would be lovely. But the reality is that these are literally done by hitting the enter button on your keyboard.
Absolutely.
It is that simple. And having been a trader for years, I love the analogy that your speaker used calling cocaine brain. I've never heard that, but it is very true. It's akin to someone going to Vegas. And they're making money, and they're making money, and then all of a sudden they start losing, and they can't grasp that they're losing. So they might double down to try to make their money back, you know, in one fell swoop. And ultimately what happens is they just lose more and more and more until they implode. And that's sort of what happens, unfortunately, on trading desks, especially because traders typically at institutions like this get a base salary. But their real income is based on what appears to be their P&L. So you really do see this a lot more at the end of the year than you might in, like, May.
Connie, you're going to be...
they're trying to pat it.
You're going to be our next guest the next time we do a Wall Street segment. Thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate it.
That was great. Thank you.
All right. Heidi Moore, New York Bureau Chief for the Public Radio Show Marketplace. Before you go, which of these do you prefer as your New York Post headline tomorrow? The Long and Winding Rogue, A Fork in the Rogue, Swiss Mist, or UBS with the BS in quotes?
Oh, it's got to be the last one.
Yeah, got to be D. I think that'll be the consensus choice. All right, Heidi Moore, thanks a lot. We'll see what happens with this next and how far up the chain it actually goes at UBS. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. Hurricane insurance put to the test. We will talk to a consumer advocate who will take calls from many of you whose homes were damaged because of Tropical Storm Irene or Lee. How is the cleanup going? And we want to know. We want to flesh these out now. We want to get them out of your mouths onto the radio to help other people who may be having the same problems. What kinds of battles, if any, are you having with your insurance companies or with FEMA? Because if you know that other people are having the same battles, it may be easy to band together and get what's coming to you. So that's coming up next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.